I'm Marie Cardi and I'm going to die. And so are you. And so is everybody you know. In these shorter episodes, La Petite Mort, The Little Death, I'll be speaking to people about the culture of death and dying. The art we make, the words we write, the absurd and beautiful ways we all process the act of letting go. As we know, there's no wrong way to navigate grief. We need to move towards it to move through it. Behrouz Bachani is an award-winning Kurdish-Iranian writer, journalist, scholar, cultural advocate, and filmmaker. He's also lived a life that to some of us might seem unimaginable. His memoir, No Friend But the Mountains, was written during 7 years of incarceration by the Australian government in Papua New Guinea's Manus Island prison. And since his release, Behrouz has been a passionate campaigner for refugee rights. It's really interesting speaking to someone who has really had a front row seat to some of the more horrific elements of humanity about death. And I think there's a tendency to assume that he might be carrying some pretty heavy weight as a result. But Behrouz speaks so beautifully about dignity in death and death rituals and poetry and how words can hold us through dark times. He sees a lot of joy in the world, and I really love that. So it's so lovely to speak to you today and in any capacity. I do want to say that this is a podcast where I talk to people about death and dying and funerals, and sometimes in a way that's whimsical and hypothetical and poppy. But I really want to acknowledge that you're someone who has had a front row seat to a lot of death and dying in your life, too much, sure. Being born into war and conflict and Iran, and spending 6 years illegally detained at Manus Island. So death really has been a very real presence in your life for a long time.
Yes, I think it's quite interesting. So in my family, I haven't experienced someone die. So that is, I think that is a big thing when a dear one die and you experience that, and then you go through the process of grieving and, you know, understanding of the death. I think that has a huge impact on you. But for me, that didn't happen. But I've experienced seeing friends who die in Manus Island, and even later, because some of the refugees who were in Manus Island, they've been transferred to Australia, and some of them died in Australia. And most of this happened because of medical neglect, because of suicide and violence. So that is my whole experience. And also, when I came to Australia by boat, our boat was broken and we drowned on the sea, which I described in my book, that I was struggling to, you know, survive. So that is another thing. But generally, you know, in Manus Island was a system that designed that detainees all the time feel death. So death was there all the time and we could feel it. So that is my whole experience with death.
I think it's so interesting that you say, I mean, when you speak about that experience with death, that is something that so many people have never encountered, probably will never encounter, that daily reminder, the violence of it. But as you said, you haven't experienced death within a family and that kind of quite personal grief. Is there some part of you that's almost afraid of losing someone in your family that's close to you, feels like a remote, strange thing?
Yeah, I think it's different. So I mentioned I haven't experienced that. Just when I was a kid, a little kid, I think I was like 8 years old, that my grandmother died, which I remember it. And it's quite interesting. The first image that I remember of my life was the image of war, because I was born in the middle of a war between Iran and Iraq. But actually, most of this war happened on Kurdistan. So I was born in the middle of that war. And the first images that I remember of my life I think I was like 4 years old, 5 years old, something like that, was for, you know, that war. And also, I remember an image that I was in a cemetery, like I was in a funeral. I think I was like 5 years old that I remember that my mother was there. And I clearly remember even the details. It's so interesting because later I was trying to find out who died on that moment. And I found out later that that was my mother's uncle. And so that is the first image that I remember of my life, which is very attached to war and death.
I talk to a lot of people and about children going to funerals, and some people say it's very good, it's important for children to go to funerals when it's a family member because it makes them start to understand death and dying and grief and how families show up. And other people say, no, you should protect children and don't bring them to funerals. What else do you remember about when you were a child at that funeral? Do you remember adults grieving? Do you remember ritual? Do you remember sounds and smells?
Yeah, actually, I remember a quite interesting thing that someone gave me an orange, that I remember it. And also, I remember that my mother was crying and many women were there. So in Kurdish culture, we have a different, quite a special funeral. So in Kurdish culture, the many women, especially women, come and they sing a song, which is a very ancient song. So people sing that song. And also sometimes for some people who are very special people in the community, they make a bigger funeral that even people dance. But this dance is not for celebration. It's very beautiful that just people want to show their respect. And so in Kurdish culture is very special funeral and it still is like that. And I think that is really important that when someone die in Kurdish culture, so they get a funeral and after a week they get another like a ceremony. And then after 40 days and then after a year. So, I mean, that is really important that people who lost someone, they are surrounded by people, by their community and family. And I think that is really important for them to process. And I think if children go to this kind of funerals, I think it's good for them, because they learn something. And I think the questioning about death is a very big question that we as a human being, we always ask that question, always we feel it. And I think it's important that the children, they face that question. And I don't think that is a negative thing. I think it's good for children.
I think it's good for all of us, I think, as well. Would you say, are you afraid of death and dying?
Yeah, I am afraid because I love life, but I feel that I am getting older. I accept it. I don't think in future I will be afraid of death like now.
The lived experience that you have has really made you an activist. You know, you show up, you've been really outspoken about the plight of refugees and you fight. And I'm always interested in how activists look after themselves. You know, there's a lot of talk about activist burnout and the other people's trauma that you're holding on. What does it look like for you to step back and take care of yourself when you need?
Actually, when I was in Iran, of course, I was active. You know, that's why I left Iran. But I think it's very important because my work is not only about refugees. I talk about refugees in the context of colonialism in Australia. And because of my background as a Kurdish, that I grew up in a colonialism system and I experienced that. you know, all of my activities is related to that. So I'm not only working about refugees, I link refugees with some other issues, which is very important. I talk about minorities and marginalized people, but generally always I say that it's really important that we as an activist, you know, people who are active, they look after themselves as well. You know, sometimes it's important that we step back and take care of ourselves sometimes, because we should understand that the creating change doesn't happen quickly. It's happened very slowly through generations. That's why it's very important in any political movement or social movement, we always be able to recognize our achievement, because the change happened very slowly, and that's why we feel that nothing changed, but actually something changed. We achieve something important and we create some change. It's very important that we recognize that change. We recognize our achievement, then go forward. If we look at any political movement in this way, we realize that we should look after ourselves as well.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise there's a tendency to get bogged down in the hopelessness of it all. But when you find those little kernels of seeing the historical context and seeing the small wins, then you understand you're part of something greater.
Exactly.
That's important. Yeah. You've also placed yourself in a position to bear witness to the grief of so many others. How meaningful is it for you to share that burden?
You know, it's very sad. I shared some stories with you in Manus Island, because Manus Island, of course, is a part of my life, and it's a long time. It's 6 years at least. So 6 years, I cannot ignore those 6 years that I was fighting so hard. And I think that is very important. So on that time that we were in Manus Island, so in Manus Island, 8 people killed by the system. So the first one was Reza Barati. You know, there are some big names now that these people died in Manus Island. And what we did as a detainee, I think that was interesting, that we always got a ceremony for them. And just all of the detainees get together inside the prison, and we stay with each other and just to process that, because that is really important. In Manus Island, death is a very important concept, because as I mentioned before, the whole system, the whole prison was designed that we always feel death. So when someone died in that system, in that context by the system, people feel afraid, because they see that that's possible that they die as well. That's possible that that happened for them as well. Always I remember Salim, he was a Rohingya refugee in Manus Island, and he was extremely sick. And when Faisal Ahmad Ishaq, he was, I wrote about all of these people in my articles, my journalism works. So for people who want to know, they can go and Google them. He came to me the day that Faisal Ahmad Ishaq, who was an African refugee, died. Salim came to me, and he didn't know English at all. He couldn't speak English, but he was trying to tell me that this is going to happen for me as well. And he was demanding for help. He was demanding for support. But of course, I was a detainee and I couldn't help him. And after 4 or 5 months, Salim was died as well. And that is one of the moments that I never forget it, because I remember how he was helpless, how he was tired of that system and how he was afraid of the system. And he approached me and he couldn't speak English. He was just struggling to say that. I mean, that I experienced something like that, you know. And in those ceremonies that we had in Manus Island, I remember when Reza Barati was killed and we got a ceremony. And our ceremony, we did nothing, just we stand together, you know, and some people did a speech or like that. And then one of the officers, who was a Maori officer from New Zealand, he came to the ceremony and he did a haka. Haka is a Maori performance. And he did that to show respect. And that was very powerful, you know. I mean, in Manus Island, in that context, is really different when we talk about death, because even those ceremonies, the funeral that we had in Manus Island, I think is very important, not only in the process of grieving. It was important because it was an act of resistance as well, because the system was designed to dehumanize us. But when you have a funeral, when you get together, you remind of yourself that you are a human being. You bring your dignity back. And I think this kind of funeral, especially in a context of Manus Island, is an act of resistance as well. It's culture. It's culture. So I like to write about this on future. I like to do more research about it to understand it more, that how getting a funeral in a context like Manus Island in a prison, how that was a funeral that was made by people with different backgrounds. We created a funeral that was only belong to refugees and detainees in Manus Island. It was not belong to other culture. A part of it was come from the like Islamic culture, come from Kurdish culture, from Sri Lankan culture, from different culture get together. And we created our own funeral, a special culture that was only for us. So I mean that in Manus Island, in that context, we, of course, we can't talk about death and funeral and all of this a lot. Like people who lose a member of their family, father, mother, or like that, in Manus Island, how is their feeling? And how other detainees show their support? I mean, that's quite interesting.
And you said it, you know, the funeral in Manus Island, it was symbolism and ritual. And you said it was a re-anchoring to your humanity. And in that humanity, it is acknowledging that you're grieving, because I would assume that being in that detention, you have to compartmentalize a lot of your emotions. You can't just consistently be connecting to your grief and your rage and your confusion and your pain. But in those moments, you gave each other space to feel those things, to feel the sadness, to feel the grief, to feel the loss. And that symbolism and ritual was important to keep you all alive as well.
Exactly. So, I mean, that was like a sharing a same experience as well, because all of us, we were in the same position, in the same circumstances. So, I mean, that sharing is like a member of a family who lose their father, for example, and how they approach each other in the funeral, how they support each other, how they take care of each other, you know. So in Manus Island was like that. It was a kind of a brotherhood in that funeral, and it was peaceful, you know. It was a peaceful environment. And I think, as I mentioned, in the same time was an act of resistance as well, that we still are alive. And they send a message to the system that we are here and we are together and we are going to continue to resist until we get freedom.
And thank you for sharing that. It's incredibly beautiful and incredibly important to talk about acts of resistance. And I know that you first came under the gaze of authorities when you were teaching Kurds to write, which at the time was considered a very illegal and dangerous activity. So I know in Manus you wanted to help people from your country read and write in their own language, and that was so important to you to preserve this language, to not have the death of a language. You know, you wanted to ensure that Kurdish language lived on. It's obviously so important to you to keep the language alive as much as everything else.
Yes, I think that is the biggest tragedy that I ever witnessed in my life, is how a language is getting weak, a language that is dying. I think that is the biggest tragedy that always makes me emotional when I think about it. And that is something I know that people who are not minority, probably they cannot understand it. They cannot understand it. That how a language that is your mother language. I'm not an old person, but I've seen the process of like dying a language in just 2 decades. Mm-hmm. I don't say that the Kurdish language is dead already. No, you know, I come from a part of Kurdistan that because Kurdistan has 4 or 5 dialects. So some of these dialects, you know, already had the chance to be developed and become a modern language. For example, a language like in Kurdish, we have many books in philosophy, but in Kurdish, like Heidegger, I don't know, Freud, Nietzsche, this kind of philosophers already translated to Kurdish. So that means that Kurdish language is capable and is modern enough that we talk about philosophy, modern philosophy. But that part of Kurdistan that I come from, I'm talking about the particular dialect that like about 3 million people speak with that dialect, which is my dialect. And in that part of Kurdistan, we are losing that language. And I think that is a huge tragedy. But, you know, I dedicated my life, like some other people, other writers, that we write in this language. We at least save this language in literature and we keep it until we have a political chance, you know, an opportunity that we bring this language into education system, into media, and, you know, that people learn it again. But as I mentioned before, you know, this is a huge tragedy that I experienced in my life.
Yeah, I mean, it is a grief as well. I mean, we talk about grief attached to humanity, but grief attached to language is just as important. And I know you typed a lot of your book, your first book, in text messages while you were illegally incarcerated. How important do you think words and language has been, and words and writing, to your personal survival?
I think, of course, I was writing to expose that system, and I did it, you know, alongside other people. You know, I published 2 books, so people can go and like film and many works. So we created a huge body of work to expose that system. So that was my motivation, that was my mission. So for people who want to know about detention system in Australia, who want to know about Manus, Nauru, and those systems, there is a huge body of works already. So they can go and read them and do research. And so I think we expose that system in many level. I wrote about that system in different aspects, you know, about even indigenous people on Manus Island. And they link to that system. So, I mean, already a huge body of works created. But when I think about it, writing in that system in the same time is an act of survival as well. You know, I survived through my writing. And when I say survive, it's not mean that I just get out of that system. That means I protect my mind as well. So I came out as a healthy person, mentally, I mean. So, of course, that happened through my writing, you know, to expose that system. That's happened, you know, in Kurdistan, we say resistance is life, you know. And I think that is true. That happened for me as well.
But you were a lover of writing and reading long before you were incarcerated. And I know that in 2013, when you left Iran, you had a book of poetry with you. How has your love and attachment to poetry, to literature, to writing and words shifted from 2013 to today, since you've experienced so much in the middle?
I've learned a lot, and I think I've changed a lot. Because a big part of it is not because of only Manus. It's because I get older, you know. So when you are, of course, when you are like 28 years old, you are not an experienced writer, you know. It takes time. So it's like a process of becoming a writer, or, you know. So, of course, I was much younger on that time. So, and also, you know, that experience in Manus Island, you know, of course, that helped me to learn more. And that definitely had a huge impact on me as a person. But I don't know. I feel that Manus and those 6 years actually made me a better person. At least that is my feeling about myself. I'm not saying ethically. I'm talking about myself, that how I feel about myself. I think that I became more a beautiful person compared to before. Yeah, it's just a personal feeling I'm talking about.
I really love that. And I can see that too. You talked about writing as an act of resistance, and sometimes reading itself can be an act of resistance, people picking up work to access those stories. Do you ever write and read and find escapism there? Can you find stories and poetry and romance and escapist elements in writing?
I don't look at the writing as a place to escape. I know that many people, they just write. They say, just write about yourself, and that help you feel better. But I don't want to use this word, like a professional writer, someone who is his job to just write, I think writing is scary. I don't look at it as a place to escape, you know. If I don't write, I escape.
What do you do to escape? What do you do to switch off?
I don't escape. I play football.
You talked about growing older and facing your own mortality. You've already lived so many lives and done so much. What are the things that you still want to accomplish before you die?
I don't think about die. Actually, I haven't think about it like this. Probably when I get much older, I think about what I should do next before I die. But when I look at my life and my journey, you know, I'm a very experienced person in many ways, but in many ways, I'm like a boy. I haven't experienced things, you know. So I like to experience something new, you know, and just enjoy my life, you know. That's what I do, just enjoy my life. I enjoy it in my own way.
You certainly deserve a lot of joy, I think. And apart from football, what are the things that do bring you joy, or things that you'd like to experience that are joyous?
To be honest, I don't enjoy football as much as before anymore, because if I was a professional footballer, I think it was the time that I retired. So for playing a football and enjoy it, of course, you need a very, very young body. My body is not flexible as much as before. Just generally, I like watching films, reading, you know, listening to poetry, stories. That is my life. And walking, I walk a lot. I like nature. That is my joy. It's not a big thing.
And a final question, how do you hope, I know that we're not thinking, you're not going to die for a very long time, you're going to be very old and accomplished and happy and full of joy and lots of nature walks. How do you hope that you will be remembered?
I don't think about it. I think it doesn't matter how people remember me, really. I think when you die, it's finished, it's over. I'm not a religious person, you know, I born in a place that there was not religion at all there, and my parents were not religious at all. So, yeah, I'm not a religious person. I don't believe in God or these kind of things. So for me, when you die, it's over. But that doesn't mean that in our life, we just live without any purpose or any motivation, you know. I think my mission in this world is to live in a way to do something for this society, something for people, and has an impact on this world, you know, in this society. So that is my motivation. And I believe in working. People should work all the time, you know. I try to do something for this society, for this world, and make it as a better place. That is my mission. Yeah,
I think you've already done that so successfully, and I know you've been awarded for your writing, you've been revered for your humanitarian work. I know that you've spoken so much about your trauma, you've shared so much vulnerability in order to continue those acts of resistance and awareness and to bring people into that story. I think it's incredibly beautiful that what you've taken from that is that you've become a more beautiful person. And I think I can see that it's palpable in you, and your access to joy in nature is moving and wonderful and brilliant. And I feel very privileged to have spoken to you in any capacity. And I thank you from my heart for the work that you have done and what you've put into the world.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's my pleasure.
I always bang on about how this podcast is as much about survival as it is about death, but my God, if there were ever a more beautiful example of elegance and grace in articulating survival. I know it takes a lot for advocates to ensure their own mental health is in order so they can carry on fighting, and he's such a North Star. To hear someone so internally anchored is really inspiring. Behrouz's latest book, Freedom, Only Freedom, was published in 2022. Having conversations about grief can really stir up some unexpected feelings. So if anything's arisen for you today as a result of something you've heard, please look after yourself. I fully acknowledge it's a privilege to talk about mortality in this way, and there are so many specific resources available as part of the show notes, so look them up. Check in on how you're feeling internally, call a friend, take a walk, pat a dog, just trust yourself. It really would mean a lot if you'd consider supporting the show in whatever way you can. You do you, babe. You can subscribe to Marie Cardi Is Going to Die on Patreon. And signing up means you'll have a monthly newsletter, writing updates, Q&A. There's a whole community on there of people that I just adore. So please join. This wild and weird podcast is made by me, Marie Josephine Hardy, and a team of fully golden hearts. Sammy Peterson, Darren Scarce, Camilla McEwen, Eamon Leggett, and Lauren Egan. Our beautiful podcast theme music is by my dear friend, Lord Fascinator. And I'd like to give special thanks to James Milsom and Amelia Chapelot.